I think platform as a function could potentially use a rebrand. At the very highest level, platform covers the activities or services beyond direct investment. Now, at InMotion Ventures, when I first joined, there was no platform strategy in place. And
Interesting.
to be honest, it felt like no one was entirely sure what I was there to do. I think on my first day, I was introduced as about three different things. Someone said, "This is Ollie, he's our platform lead. This is Ollie, he's our head of marketing. This is Ollie, he's our operations guy." And I
Yeah.
was like, "Well, does anyone know why I'm here? Like, yeah, thanks for the job, but let's strip it back a bit."
Now, Oliver has to be one of the smartest platform leads I know, and I'm so happy we finally got to shoot our episode together this week. He leads platform at InMotion Ventures, which is the investment arm of JLR, Jaguar Land Rover, and yes, that's the car company. They invest in pre-seed to Series A in climate, industrial, and enterprise tech globally. On this episode, we talk about why corporate venture capital, CVC, is different from traditional venture capital, how InMotion Ventures' competitive advantage helps them support founders in a super, super unique way. I've never heard of this one before. Why specialization is key when you define your own platform functions at your own fund, and how he keeps tabs on what his portfolio founders need support with, and so much more. Enjoy. Okay, one, two, three. Oliver, super, super excited to have you on. I know we had to spend 20 minutes just grabbing headphones and testing different kinds of mic to get this episode going. So there's been a lot of effort in preparation for this episode. So really happy to have you on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mash. And like I was saying to you earlier, these headphones don't really suit my image, but I'm glad we finally managed to hear each other. And I'm really looking forward to this discussion. I guess I also need to say thank you on behalf of my platform peers for spotlighting us and what we do. And clearly I'm biased, but it's a hugely exciting and rarely explored aspect of venture.
Love it. You know, next time we do an episode, we can get the more, smaller wireless earbuds.
Please,
Yeah,
please.
that's the plan. So to get the audience as just as excited as I am to have you on, Oliver, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're up to?
Happy to, yeah. So I'm Oliver Fitzgibbon. Ollie, to most people, was born and raised in London, and as you can probably tell, it's still home for me today. I live in the southeast of the city with my wonderful wife, Kate, who's a primary school teacher, and our very active, very funny 18-month-old son, Ruben. So that's home. But in my work life, I lead platform at InMotion Ventures. We are the investment arm of JLR, Jaguar Land Rover, and I'm sure we'll get into the detail of who the fund is and exactly what I do through the course of this conversation.
When I was doing my research on your fund and who you are, when I saw you're backed by Jaguar Land Rover, obviously I went onto the website to look at all the 2024 models, and I looked at the Jaguar F-Type and the different Range Rovers that you have. Very, very impressive cars. So before we get into all things VC, Oliver, kind of curious, like I talked to a lot of people in the platform space and realizing that everyone has a very diverse background before they get into VC, if not everyone, but at least 80%. In your case, were you always in VC? And if not, tell us about that, what that background was before you joined the venture capital industry.
Yeah, happy to. And like you said, I, like many of my platform peers, and I do think of them as peers rather than competitors. We're very collaborative. I had a non-linear path into VC. I don't come from investment banking or a sort of consulting background. So I guess by way of an introduction and to give a bit of color to myself, I've always been interested in the sort of startup world. My parents were entrepreneurs. I guess you would call them exited founders, but they would just call themselves business people who sold their business when it got to the end of the road. So I had exposure to that world, and I knew I wanted to be in it. And I was interested in the venture model, but when I graduated back in 2014, I think it was, platform roles didn't exist, and I didn't have the desire or frankly qualifications to become an investor. So what that meant is I built an early career where I operated at the intersection of innovation and marketing, and I've been fortunate enough to work with startups, scale-ups, large corporates across a huge range of sectors. And it's only really in moments like this and in conversations like this, with the benefit of hindsight, where I look back and I think actually all roads did lead to venture. I would love to say that was by design, but honestly, it was more serendipitous. So I can jump into examples. In my very first role when I graduated was with a startup founded by an ex-IBMer, an ex-IBM sales lead who really understood the value of community before community was really a thing. Today, we all talk about community. It's in my job title. But 10 years ago, that was fairly niche. And he was essentially building and still is building a sales and marketing agency that essentially built communities for their clients and then went on to monetize that community. So the model was quite simple: bring together business leaders around sort of shared function, shared interest to talk, to exchange, and then slowly over time, identify opportunities to sell to that community. And I know you understand the value of it, but that really sort of opened my eyes to a new way of, of building businesses. And after that, then I spent the best part of 8 years or so in different marketing agencies. So some very large, such as Ogilvy, who you may be familiar with, some much smaller. And I worked with everyone from Nike, Converse, Beats, you know, these kind of consumer brands we know and love, to high growth startups, predominantly in the Bay Area, doing everything from biotech to D2C to crypto, and also working a lot of investors. So VCs, corporates, a bit of private equity. And the common thread was innovation, innovation in terms of launching new products, new technologies, new funds. So my background on a more granular level is really everything from brand messaging, identities, product launches, digital campaigns, PR. And it was really from those agency years that I built this kind of understanding of an interest in brand. And like I mentioned earlier, innovation. And I suppose just wrapping this point up, I had my first major exposure to platform in the role prior to where I am now, which is where I was working at a consultancy founded by 2xVCs that really specialized in helping funds and startups position themselves in the market, either to, in the case of startups, raise venture capital, or in the case of funds, you know, raise their own fund. And so a lot of my time was spent advising founders, building investment decks, helping companies raise money. So I don't have the total figure, but raised literally hundreds of millions of dollars, and educating investors on the importance of differentiation when it comes to brand. And a lot of my clients were platform people. And I thought, well, this is a fascinating role, right? And I'm kind of doing this role, albeit on an agency side. And that's when I first got my exposure. And I thought, hang on, there is a world in which I could work in venture. And I now sort of see this path in and made the jump over to InMotion Ventures. And here we are.
You know, that's a very fascinating story, first of all, Ollie. On top of that, I want to mention that when I was building out Hire CMO, there was one phone call I had with someone from Stripe. And, you know, me being ambitious, I wanted to partner with Stripe for another project that I was on. And then he said, you know what, Mash, a partnership with Stripe may not be viable at this time, but have you considered working with VCs? And there was a random phone call at a 2 p.m. evening or afternoon on some random weekend a year ago. And that conversation is what sprouted my thinking for how Hire CMO could be working with VCs. And I say that because I find that the more intelligent people you talk to, you actually increase your bandwidth for getting lucky and talking with people who might actually end up giving you the signal for where you should be. And it seems like in your career, Ale, the common thread is innovation. But as you work through the years from 2014 onwards, you got closer and closer to the VC space, to the platforms, working at the company that's been founded by XVCs. It's almost like the venture capital space was calling out your name slowly 100%. But surely.
100%. And but like you say, if you had told me in that first role, you know, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years from now, you'll be in venture, I would say, how? There's no way, right? Like I'm not an investor. And I said platform roles didn't exist. I think maybe they did, but maybe there was two or three people doing it. Now there's, you know, thousands of us. So it's a timing thing as well, right? But yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about venture capital, Oliver, you know, I'm kind of curious, and I'm based out of Canada. You're a second guest from the UK. Our last person was Darcy from Outward VC, spectacular person. I think that's a common thread across everyone from the UK. So how's the VC space there up in the UK and Europe in general? Because, you know, I'm trying to compare how things are in the UK versus, let's say, the US. And what are some like trends that you're seeing in 2023, 2024? Really want to pick your brain on that one.
Yeah, so, I mean, like the rest of the world, European founders and investors have faced some challenging conditions over the last year. And I mean, honestly, there's not a huge amount to say about that that hasn't already been said. However, we have seen some resilience. I don't know if you're familiar with the Atomico State of European Tech report that was released, I want to say in December last year. But it's a hugely comprehensive piece of research. I think it's hundreds of pages long, covering all things European tech, clearly. And one of their headline messages was that despite the significant pullback in funding, overall funding levels in Europe last year were still the third highest on record. I don't have the total number in dollars. I think it was about 40 billion, maybe dollars. Now, if you had told us that at the start of 2023, we would have bitten your hand off, right? You would have said that's amazing. So perhaps that's just a sign of the correction. Like, yes, it is a huge step back from the year before, but actually, zooming out, we're still looking okay. Clearly not where you want to be. Now, looking into 2024, maybe we'll see a small improvement, but it's still going to be a difficult fundraising environment. And what I think, and this will become quite apparent through the course of this conversation, is that genuine domain expertise and specialized and relevant networks are going to become the order of the day. So, what that means, I guess, at a deeper level is that, in my view, funds with a very narrow focus and a very clear strategic purpose are going to be the winners. As founders look for that sort of, I guess, that edge that an investor can bring beyond just capital. And look, I will get into it. And I mentioned with the sole, Jaguar Land Rover, our sole LP, but that growing demand for specialists rather than generalist capital is great news for funds like ours. We saw the shift at the, I guess, towards the middle of last year, and we've now had the opportunity to compete for some really exceptional deals. And between you and I, I'm hopeful that that will remain the case for a while, because it's a great time to be the kind of fund that we are.
That's fascinating, and I'll tell you why. I talk to a lot of funds, Oliver, and there's a bunch of LPs. I remember emailing one fund, and the person said, "Mash, I'd love to be on your podcast, but I'm literally fundraising for a fund right now. Let's reconnect in Q1." And I sent that email 3 months ago, right? And I think being a fund where there's a sole LP, you get to focus your time, energy, and effort onto other aspects. The particular one being actually supporting your portfolio founders so that they can, A, build a resilient brand and product, but also help them grow and scale. So I think that's a good segue for me to ask you about your fund, Oliver. Talk to us about, you mentioned specialist funds, so I'm kind of curious, talk to us about your fund in particular, your thesis, and the kind of founders you want to back. Because, I read on LinkedIn that you're one of the most active funds in Q3 in last year. So,
Yeah, absolutely. We were one of the most active funds in Q3 last year, and since 2018, we're one of the most active climate tech investors in the automotive space, which are obviously statistics that we're very proud of. But I guess a bit of background on Emotion Ventures. We were founded in 2017, early stage investing, so investing typically pre-seed to Series A, but we are a little bit loose with that thesis. We can go to Series B if needed. Clearly, JLR is a fantastic solo LP to have, and you'll recognize some of the brands that it's known for: Defender, Range Rover, Discovery, Jaguar as well. And as a corporate venturing arm, we are strategic investors. Now, clearly, there's nothing strategic about losing money. We are here to make money, absolutely. But the reason we exist is also very clear, and we make no secrets of it. We're here to invest in technologies with the potential to accelerate the transformation of JLR, so to accelerate the JLR strategy. Now, in terms of our thesis, what's super interesting about automotive today is there are multiple strands of innovation that you might consider once in a generation changes. So think about the move from ICE internal combustion engines to electrification. Think about emerging ownership models. So there are vehicle subscription services out there. There's the changing relationships between automakers and their customers. There's everything around 5G and connectivity. I could go on, but each of these in silo are massive, massive changes. But in our industry, they're all happening at the same time. So that's super exciting. But the flip side is, how do you stay focused? Because there's then a temptation to, be investing in hundreds of different verticals. So have had to spend a bit of time, and we're still going through this exercise now, thinking about where do we really want to, I guess, invest our time, our money, our energy. And the four verticals we're looking at the moment, are climate tech. Now, that's very broad. So what I mean by that is a lot of low to no carbon materials. JLR as a business has been telling people for 100 years that leather is luxury. Now we have to tell people that leather is, you know, not as good as it first, you know, first was. So what are the alternatives out there? The other part of climate tech is around, you know, industrial decarbonization. We then look at electrification. So battery management systems, second life, reuse. It's no secret that there's a lot more EVs on our road, which means there's going to be a lot more spent cells that we need to figure out what to do with them. So that's a big focus. And then the other two areas, one we call Industry 5.0, which is funny because most people are still on 4.0, but essentially that's everything around. It's our umbrella term for all things manufacturing, supply chain. And then the last one is enterprise tech. So infrastructure, looking at AI, MLOps, dev tools, and then applications. So even though we've gone, I say it, you know, this sort of, I guess a little sarcastically, more focused, clearly that's sort of fairly broad thesis. But we're quite clear on exactly what we mean by each of those, which makes our life a little bit easier. So that's where we're looking. Our portfolio is not huge, and candidly, we don't plan on it being huge. We're about, I think, 18 strong at the moment, split between Europe and the US. But we are scaling, as you mentioned. We've been very, very active. And building on that earlier point about how founders want specialist capital, we're entering what I like to call the golden age of CVC. You know, if you think about our model in the context of fundraising environments, we don't have to fundraise, as you mentioned. So that takes that off our plate.
Yeah.
Our capital comes with highly valuable, given the climate, revenue opportunities for startups in the form of proof of concepts, commercial partnerships. We then draw on our operational backgrounds, so not just mine, but also our teams, to advise founders in areas such as go-to-market or product strategy. And I think the last and I guess most interesting point is through association with us and through leveraging our sort of vast network of SMEs or subject matter experts, we're able to essentially prove product market fit for our portfolio. So
it's huge.
So that is a massive in the context of I guess early stage, right? Having someone like JLR almost put a stamp of approval on your technology.
You know, I've been listening to you, and as I'm listening to you, there's these, you know, bulbs going off in my head, or rather coming on in my head. And one of them is, you as a fund get so much insight into startups who are quite literally building on the frontier of technology, right? And then finding creative ways to add value to those startups, because you probably have, you know, subject matter expertise at the JLR brand that you can work that can work with these portfolio founders, and the other way as well, because now you as the company get insight into what could be in the next Range Rover, you know, technology that could be in the next Range Rover, because another portfolio company was able to develop some extraordinary technology that's not present in, let's say, you know, other competing car brands like Mercedes or other luxury brands, right? And I find that super fascinating, because not a lot of funds that I talk to are actually able to have such focused value add. Generally, when I talk to other platform teams, they'll say they help with fundraising, which is number one, you know, helping them get to the next stage. And then there's some additional marketing or product help, et cetera. But in your case, although there's a few pillars, it seems, of startup, of the kinds of industries that you invest in and the kinds of platform services that you provide, which we'll get to in a bit, I do sense a focused mission to not just bring the portfolio companies into the next stage of their development, but also the JLR brand itself as well. And I find that very fascinating, Oliver. Like, that's very unique. Yeah.
It is, and it's something, you know, the CVC, the corporate venturing model, doesn't get a huge amount of airtime because, and we were talking about this earlier offline, is that, you know, up until fairly recently, corporates were held at arm's length when it comes to investing, because people used to think, oh, they're very slow, they can't do deals quickly, they want exclusivity. But it's not the case. I mean, we've co-invested alongside most other automakers. So just yesterday, we had on Friday, a Series B announcement went out, and we invested alongside Porsche. We've invested alongside, I mean, Daimler, Ford, you name it, we've invested alongside them, right? So there's no exclusivity there. And for us, it's a rising tide lifts all ships in a way. You know, for a technology to be successful, it needs to needs to be in more than just a defender, right? But clearly we do look for, I guess, some kind of preferential treatment. But I think it goes back to what you just alluded to, you know, and if I tie it into what we look for in founders, we look for people, founders who can demonstrate a clear understanding of our mission. So like we've been very clear, we're here to accelerate the strategic transformation of JLR. We want to meet founders who come to our meetings, to, you know, our first calls, ready to explain why they're a strong fit to our fund. Yeah. The other side of that is we only want to invest in businesses where we feel we can make a genuine difference. You know, our fund is about mutual growth. And that means moving the needle for everyone and making a strong impact on a business's trajectory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, bluntly, we can't do that for everyone. You know, we'd love to make a lot more investments, but we need to pick the people that we think we can really make a difference to. Otherwise, we're not being, you know, true to our sort of positioning, our value add, right? And so we're doing a lot more at the earlier stage, which is quite unusual for corporates. You don't see a huge amount of corporates investing in pre-seed or seed.
That's very true.
But we feel that's where we can have the greatest impact. So mm-hmm. we're really doubling down on that space. Now, there is another reason for that, that earlier stage. And it ties back to what we were talking about earlier, is that historically, perhaps corporates wouldn't be shown or wouldn't see all the deals. We're now seeing institutional funds coming to us at the pre-seed, seed stage with opportunities as they want us to go first. It's almost like we want JLR to validate this technology. We want you to prove that there is a problem here. So that has opened up a whole world of early stage opportunities where we're now being asked to go ahead of the institutional funds, and you know, candidly, it's something we're really enjoying. But I suppose the final point on the kind of people we like to work with, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people you've spoken with, but we place a huge emphasis on whether or not we like to spend time with this person. You know, in venture, you spend a lot of time having very tricky conversations. So you want to be working with someone, you want to invest with the kind of people that you are comfortable having those conversations with and who are comfortable having those conversations with you, but also the kind of founders that you're excited to celebrate the wins with. You know, this is a long-term commitment spanning multiple years. It's kind of like a marriage, right? So you have to have that chemistry piece. And if that's not there, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to look past it, and no matter how exciting the business itself is.
I want to point something out, Ali. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but you keep using these words like defender, accelerate. These are every time you do it, I'm like, is that a pun? Because it's so funny. Maybe using these terms.
Maybe this is my branding brain coming through, that I spent so long talking about what we do that it's traction. Maybe it's at some point. Yeah, I mean, it's not deliberate, but perhaps subconsciously it is.
And then when you're in a meeting and when people are talking too much, you go, guys, let's just hit the brakes. Okay.
Hit the brakes, pump the brakes. Exactly. Yep, yep. Exactly. Good
That's
spot.
Pretty funny. But as you're talking through the fund itself, Ali, one thing I realized is that it's a very unique value proposition for your fund. The fact that other folks are coming to you to go first, it's almost like saying, guys, you guys are very proper focused on your mission, the company and the fund. You know what you want, you know why you're investing, and you focus on specific founders who can understand that vision and you know you can add value to. And so being able to go in and putting that stamp of approval saying, yep, makes sense. We've spoken to our SMEs internally. And yes, this is technology that if developed, if it comes to fruition, will bring dividends for everybody at the table. I think being mm-hmm. able to say that as a fund, not just signals to other funds that you guys know what you're doing, but also gives confidence to founders to better understand how you can be working with them together. So I guess speaking of benefits and speaking of helping founders succeed, let's dig into the platform side of your fund, because that's the meat of the podcast where I get extra excited. So, you know, how do you see the word platform? You know, you've been working in the platform space for a bit now. Talk to us about how you see this term and how other founders are seeing the term. And how has the platform function been developed at InMotion Ventures over the last year?
Yeah, and it's a great question, because we'll probably talk about this later, but I think platform as a function could potentially use a rebrand, because it's a very broad term, and I think it's deliberately a broad term. But how do I define platform? At the very highest level, I would say platform covers the activities or services beyond direct investment at a fund. And these are the activities or services that serve the needs of the portfolio or the needs mm-hmm. of the fund itself. And in our case, the needs of the parent organization, so the needs of JLR. That's a very, very broad definition. Now, at InMotion Ventures, when I first joined, there was no platform strategy in place. And, to be honest, it felt like no one was entirely sure what I was there to do. I think on my first day, I was introduced as about three different things. Someone said, this is Ollie, he's our platform lead. This is Ollie, he's our head of marketing. This is Ollie, he's our operations guy. And yeah. I was like, well, does anyone know why I'm here? Like, yeah, thanks for the job, but let's strip it back a bit. I mean, initially this was hugely exciting, right? Because I felt like, great, we've got a blank canvas. Let's do loads of our own events. Let's speak at every conference. Let's build a mm-hmm. job board. Let's build a resource library. You know, you name it, we can do it. I'm now happy to admit that was a massive mistake, because we had all these tactics, if you mm-hmm. can call them that, but there was no strategy behind them. So what I did, and it's the first time I've ever done this, and hopefully the last time, is I almost re-interviewed myself for the role now once I had it. So basically spent 2 months defining what platform meant at InMotion Ventures. So interviewing all of our team, interviewing our founders, mm-hmm. asking what the fund level objectives are, and then mapping those to my personal background and building a strategy off the back of it. Because what people, and I'm sure others on your podcast have said, but what people need to realize about platform is, for it to really work, it has to be, or for it to work as a function, it has to be integrated with the rest of the fund. You can't operate in silo. Otherwise, no one knows what you're doing and no one actually appreciates why you're there. So I view platform as the other part of the product. If capital is one product, the platform is the other, and they have to work together. So in our case, our fund objectives are fairly simple, and this is at a very high level, but it's to invest in exceptional businesses, mm-hmm. to establish market presence. So those are what I think of external activities. And then the other two are to add value to our portfolio and to add value to JLR. And what that means is our platform is structured in a fairly simple way around four areas. So the external bit, and think of this as top of the funnel, sort of building pipeline, is comms. So all things PR, brand marketing, mm-hmm. and events. So my goal here is to make sure everyone knows who InMotion Ventures is. And then the other side, and I view this as customer success, so imagine the sort of inverse funnel, is corporate relations, network, and resources. So coming good on our promise to founders, which you touched on earlier, facilitating yep. those POCs, facilitating discussions with JLR, but then also introducing them to other investors that we know, other OEM investors. So when I say OEM, I mean, automakers. So four simple buckets, but directly related to the fund objectives. Mm-hmm. And since that initial mapping exercise, I would mm-hmm. say the scope has remained largely the same, but it's become professionalized and much more refined over the past 2 years. And we can dig into that a little later if it needs to be.
Interesting. So it seems like there's, within the platform piece, there's the internal piece where what you do as part of platform is to benefit the fund, bring more awareness to the fund. And the other side is to actually help those portfolio companies figure out their product, gain product market fit, validate product market fit, and then help them scale. When it comes to supporting the portfolio founders, Ollie, talk to me about like how that turns out. Like, I'm very curious to know what would that look like in practicality? And I'll give you an example. I was talking to this fund out of Midwest, and interestingly, what they do is they build relationships with executives at corporations, like very well-known corporations. And then when their portfolio companies are trying to get their first big logo on their homepage to sell to those corporations, the platform fund actually facilitates those introductions between the executives at a corporate fund and the founder of one of their portfolio companies. And that helps their own pipeline, and so that the founders can get more sales down the road, get more intros, get more handshakes, et cetera. So that's an example from what I've seen in the past from one specific fund in the States. But I'm kind of curious, for your fund, when it comes to supporting portfolio companies, what does that look like in practicality? If I was a portfolio founder today, you know, what things could I come to you for support, and how would you and your team support me?
Yeah, absolutely. And the sort of the easy, I guess, initial response is it depends on, mm-hmm. on what we're talking about here. So let's start with the corporate relations bit, because that's the more complex. We I guess can almost act as that initial business development arm, but it's an internal business development arm, if that makes sense. So we've spent a long time with decision makers within JLR mapping where innovation is happening, taking the time to understand what internal teams are working on, where they're innovating in-house, which technologies they're excited about, so we can fine-tune our thesis in a way that makes a real difference to those teams. And because we know exactly which areas are of importance and are priority to the business, we have a very strong pull from internal stakeholders, which means connecting our portfolio to the business is actually not a huge challenge. The challenge for us is pre-investment. So we need sponsorship. And it's funny because if you were to speak with most investors and you say, oh, I spoke to a corporate investor and he says he needs sponsorship, they roll their eyes and they go, oh, impossible. But in my mind, going back to the markets as they are, it makes perfect sense because sponsorship means there's a commitment from JLR, and I want to be certain that JLR as a business is willing to work with our portfolio companies. And without that initial sponsorship, we can't guarantee that. So it's
Interesting.
almost a prerequisite to being able to act on our sort of our promise. So going back to your
Interesting.
question, a lot of that is once the investment is done, how can we support on the corporate relations bit? It's just making sure people are having the conversations, making sure things are moving. If things stall, using our ability to essentially be the kind of the mole within the business to remove blockers, to chat to the procurement team. So a lot of it is almost a sort of project management side of things. But we have sway within the business because JLR or InMotion Ventures as a business owns a certain percentage of that company, right? So there is an interest in working with them. So I think that's the corporate relations side. In terms of the other side, comms, events and whatnot, that's my background, right? So I mentioned earlier that we're investing earlier stage at the moment. And the reason that's sort of that's interesting is because we can really, really have a stronger impact on those kind of companies. So at the moment I'm working with one of our portfolios, a deep tech company, innovating in the semiconductor space, and they know a huge amount about their product, very technical founders, but don't I guess sort of have the time or candidly the skill set to turn that offering into go-to-market messaging that appeals to non-technical buyers. So I'm spending a lot of time, and this isn't scalable, and in my view it doesn't need to be scalable, but I've spent a lot of time working with these founders actually building out their messaging, right? So essentially doing the work for them almost like an agency but for free. Which I think is a, I mean, I would say this, right? But I think it's a huge value add because you're
It
saving
is.
yourself literally thousands of pounds, and hopefully you have something that's very actionable, and that company will hopefully be raising money in the not too distant future, and we'll be able to use the work we've done to to make that process a little bit
Yeah.
smoother.
And Ollie, the other part is that you're from the fund. And so again, there is the commonality of the mission. The founder, yourself, and JLR, everyone understands why you're helping and for what purpose. Whereas if you brought in another external agency, they would need hours to even get the context, et cetera, et cetera. But you already have that context. That's why you guys invested, right? And so to come in with that concrete understanding of what the brand is, what they're trying to achieve, because you've had to do that due diligence in the past anyway, it's not just saves time, but it also puts the founder and you on the same page much, much faster, enabling you to actually accomplish more in shorter periods of time. So you're accelerating
Absolutely.
their work.
Good little pun there as well.
Of course. Of course, had to. Speaking about platform, Oliver, one thing I wanted to touch on is how are you seeing this industry evolve? Like when you're looking, because it seems like some funds are specialist funds and they have extremely specific expertise. For example, the other day I heard about a fund called, I forget the name, but they're very good with regulatory stuff. So they invest in startups who help or build in the regulatory space, and then they have SMEs who know the regulatory space very, very well. Perfect match, right? Whereas other funds, like I mentioned earlier, more generic help of marketing, product, et cetera, and they're still trying to find the signal for where they should focus on. So when you're looking at the platform industry overall, how do you see that evolving, and what's platform like at other funds that are similar to yours, you think?
I think you just answered your own question. So the way I view it is that platform is a relatively new function, like we've just talked about earlier, but it is non-negotiable, and it's something that every fund that is competitive has. So there's a great group, and I know you're familiar with them, the VC platform community. There are people So it's all the, well, it should be all of the platform.
You know what's funny, Joshua? This is the fourth time Joshua got a shout out. I could just be sponsored by them.
We love the platform community. They're great because, I mean, like, I did, but this is going on a bit of a tangent, but I'm a team of one. So when I first joined, I was like, what is this all about? What are the frameworks? How do I excel in my role? What should I be speaking to my team about? And I just spoke to people at other funds, and I still did, you know, we WhatsApp the whole time. If I have a question, often I'll speak to people at other funds before my team, because I'm the only platform person here. So it's hugely collaborative, but they put out a great piece of research last year, I think in collaboration with Zendesk. I might have got that wrong, so apologies if it was
HubSpot
or someone. Thank you very much. And they put together this amazing bit of research that essentially showed that funds with platform teams have outperformed funds without platform teams over the last two decades. So the data's there. It works, right? But it's an incredibly broad term. And like we said earlier, you might speak to 10 of us and get 10 different definitions. So I feel like we're moving into what I call platform 2.0. And you've mentioned it just now. For me, platform 2.0 is all about specialization. Now, it's very easy for me to say that because I have a ready-made specialization, but what I'm seeing and what should happen is that funds are looking at their team, this includes their investment team, and saying, right, what's our expertise? What's our background? And then asking the question, where are we uniquely positioned to add value? How can our collective experience drive change in our portfolio? Now, this might sound really obvious, but in the past and potentially still today in some cases, many funds offer the same product. And it could be a little controversial to say this, but if you have multiple investors on the cap table, all offering to help founders in exactly the same way, many are by definition adding very little value, right? Like if there's eight investors and everyone has exactly the same platform, what value are you bringing? And in 99% of those cases, I imagine the founders are just going to speak to the lead investor because they've got the most skin in the game. And then others are going to be scratching their heads saying, well, you know, we've got this amazing platform, but why is it not getting engagement? It might be because it's not differentiated. So personally, I like that this specialization is happening. And you mentioned that regulatory example. I've seen the same for product. I've seen a fund that is purely focused on product. And I think it's great because it puts pressure on us as investors to be different. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've talked extensively about us. You know, we are very clear on our purpose. If you want support in areas, or if our portfolio wants support in areas such as HR strategy or sales development, there will be funds on the cap table better placed to support that. But we are literally the only fund in the world that can offer that JLR angle. So specialization becoming a thing is absolutely the trend I see. And like we said earlier, maybe platform needs a bit of a rebrand so people can kind of understand what we do as it becomes more specialized.
That's your marketing brain talking. And it wants to completely change the platform industry and take it to 2.0. I have a question for you, Oliver. So let's say that I'm a VC fund. I have a one-man or one-woman team. It's a platform team. Side note, a lot of folks in the VC platform space are actually women, which I find very fascinating.
Most
of them. Yeah, yeah. So a question for you, Oliver, is as a fund with a one-person team, platform team, how exactly do you market your capabilities to the founders, right? Because as you mentioned, cap table founders are probably going to speak to the lead investor, more teeth, more skin in the game. But let's say there is an investor on the cap table who does have a very well thought out platform capability, but the fund just never got the chance or opportunity to actually market that to the portfolio founder. So what kind of advice do you have for funds like that?
I think in that case, your platform needs to be promoted whilst you're courting the founders, right? So so in my mind, when your investment team is speaking to founders and hoping to invest in a founder, they should be promoting more than just the cash, right? They should say, if you take our money, we come with this suite of services and we have an excellent platform lead and her name or his name is X. It needs, and it goes back to that point around making sure your objectives are baked into the investment team objectives. They have to be the same thing. And in that world, if done correctly, your portfolio will be crystal clear on your suite of services. I think if you're having to sort of shoehorn your services in post-investment, or if your portfolio aren't aware of the value you can bring, there's an issue there. And I think it's sort of further upstream in my mind.
Yeah, I can see why you'd say that. And a tactical question for you, do you send, like, how do you ask your portfolio founders, if they need help with something. I know you as the platform lead or the other folks on your team, or the platform person rather, and the other folks on your team do keep tabs on your portfolio founders, but do you send routine emails to your portfolio? Sorry, what happened to my voice? One second.
No worries.
It's hilarious. So do you send out routine emails to portfolio founders to see what they need help with? Or do you have another way of keeping tabs on their progress so that you intuitively know what they might need help with, let's say 2 or 3 months down the line? Because not every founder would intuitively think of InMotion Ventures all the time for something you can help out with, right? So there needs to be that back and forth communication. So on a tactical level, how do you keep tabs on whether or not they need help?
It's a great question. And we come at this from a sort of slightly more luxurious position in that we have a small portfolio. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's only, let's say, 17, 18 in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. We know which ones of those will need support mainly based on their size. You know, some of those portfolio companies are now into the kind of Series D. They probably don't need a huge amount of support, especially not with their messaging. Let's say they've probably got an exceptional CMO who's been doing the job for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So often it's you can sort of make an educated guess. Now, I have, this is far more, tactical, but I have a weekly platform meeting and all of our team have to attend that. And it's amazing to me how few funds have that. Whenever I say that, people go, oh, what, you get all your team around a table once a week to talk about platform? And I say, absolutely. Otherwise, how do they know what I'm doing? And how do I know how I can help them, right? So part of that, and I would love to say it was my idea, but it was actually our managing director, Mike's idea. But part of that meeting, we have a whole section at the end dedicated to portfolio, and it's like, who have you spoken to in the last week? What are they up to? How can we help? And just having that cadence, and the meeting's in for an hour, sometimes it only takes 20 minutes, but having that cadence means that we have a pretty comprehensive picture of what's going on at the fund. And it means just because I'm not speaking to them, it doesn't mean they haven't had contact with, you know, one of our principals who's on their board. So we have a pretty comprehensive understanding. We can also predict, right? Like, I know which of our portfolio companies are likely to be going into a fundraising process. So we'll know, right, do we need to make any introductions here? And then once they've closed the round, let's talk about PR, because clearly there needs to be a fundraising announcement. Mm-hmm. Equally, post-investment, the first thing they're going to want to do with us is try and move forward that JLR piece. So we know that. So a lot of it is just understanding, who's in your portfolio, what their priorities are, but just making sure that someone, doesn't have to be you, but someone on the team is semi-regularly checking in. Now, like I said, if you have a portfolio of 300, that's very different. But with us at our current size, it's fine. It can be a little bit more manual.
Yeah. And I'm sensing there's learning over time as you invest in more and more startups, you're seeing the trajectory of the requests that they have over time. So right immediately after post-investment versus 3 or 6 months down the road. And also, I love that you're doing the weekly touch point, 15, 20 minutes keeps people accountable to actually coming into the call with something if they can, but also lets people discuss where the other portfolio companies are and what they're doing and what they're up to, right? So if portfolio founder A needs help with X or needed help with X 2 months ago, now might be a good time to follow up on it and ask if they need something else, right? So exactly. I love that collaborative approach. Yeah, it's super fascinating. No one's ever said that on this pod before.
Exactly. And it also keeps me accountable as well, right? Because, you know, I'm I report directly to our managing director. But if I know each week I've got to give an update on what's going on, it stops me getting distracted by something else and thinking, oh, well, let's explore this and let's spend a week doing something that isn't, you know, relevant to the core of the fund. So I like it in that sense as well, because if it gets to Thursday and I have a look at that list and think, oh, God, I haven't done these bits. Well, we're going to have a chat about it on Monday. It keeps everyone accountable.
I
would strongly encourage other people to do it, even though it sounds like it might get some resistance in other places.
Especially for bigger portfolios, I guess, and bigger fund sizes, not fund sizes, but rather, funds with more employees.
Absolutely.
So I guess speaking of advice for other funds, Ollie, I love how we have these natural organic segues. If there's a 20-something-year-old person listening to this podcast and they're not really sure if they want to work in platform, or they are sure, but they're not really confident where to begin, what are some unintuitive pieces of advice you can give them?
Yeah. I get asked this question quite a lot, as you would probably imagine. I think a place to start is we all know getting into VC is a challenge, right? It's super competitive. There's very few positions. I would say the same is true, whether it's an investor role or a platform role, but I think it's even more competitive in the platform space because there's even less positions, right? Most platform teams are teams of one or two, maybe, and maybe there's eight investors or so. So there's less roles, but a lot of people still want to do them. And unsurprisingly, I nearly fell victim to this. There's the temptation to jump into the very first opportunity that comes available, regardless mm-hmm. of thesis. And this kind of applies for any job, but I think especially in VC and in platform, you need to really give thought to what excites you and only look for opportunities in those areas. Because this may seem, wildly, glaringly obvious, but if you're a lover of early stage deep tech, are you really going to enjoy working for a growth stage fund that invests in consumer brands? If you're desperate to get in the industry, you might just say, yeah, that's fine. But in our role as heads of platform, you need to be all in on the fund. You need to be all in on the thesis, all in the portfolio. The best platform leads are hugely excited about, where their fund invests and what their portfolio are building. And without that kind of motivation, it's an incredibly hard role to do because it's not a 9-to-5, right? And you're going to struggle if you don't have that excitement, once the initial excitement of the job wears off, if you don't have that passion, it's going to be hard work. And most importantly, you're going to be doing a disservice to your founders, right? So the first bit of advice is absolutely that, is to really give thought to what excites you and resist the temptation just to go for whatever's there. I think the second bit, and it all ties to what we've been saying throughout this conversation, is if you believe like I do that platform is going towards specialization, define your skill set early, way before applying to roles, and then double down on it. So we've talked about this trend, but let's say you are really interested in talent, as an example, which is something mm-hmm. I don't know a huge amount about, but let's say that's your sort of passion, but you want to be in venture. Why not spend time as a tech recruiter? Why not join a high growth startup as their in-house HR professional? Build that experience and then look to join a fund who has a unique value that is placing talent in their portfolio. And that exists. There's a lot of people in platform who purely work on talent and they're very, very good at what they do. But I'm willing to bet they spent a lot of time working in other companies, probably in the startup space before they got there. So just give thought to that specialization. Think about, okay, if now's not the right time, how can I build up that skill set? So when the time is right, I can go, right, I want to work in this sector and I want a fund that specializes in this in their platform. And I have the sort of full suite of services.
And it also signals positive buy-in to the fund who may be hiring that person, right? If you want to work in the VC fund in talent, but you've also spent 2 or 3 years in a startup that's seen great growth and you've worked in talent and I can see that you've had some good successes in that company, to me, it tells me that, hey, you understand how startups work and how, how messy it can get sometimes and there's long hours, but not just that. You want to help us with something that you personally, selfishly, have a passion for. And I think that would excite any fund who wants to bring someone on who has the know-how, but also that oomph, like that organic oomph where they naturally gravitate towards their role. And I think that's a great point. I don't know if you noticed, Oliver, but throughout your entire, the responses that you provided, I can sense two words, and I want to think this expands to the grander InMotion Ventures team as well, which is conviction and buy-in. Buy-in from JLR to the fund, buy-in from the fund to the startups, and making sure everyone's fully aligned on that singular mission and have good conviction in moving forward with the grander picture. Right? And I really like that. That's pretty unique. It's not like you're using specific keywords. It's just evident in the way you're speaking about everything that you do and what the fund does as well. So I think that's pretty cool.
I need that in writing for my boss, please, Mash. That'd be great.
I'll send that over and be like, hey, FYI, and just like attach it. No context.
Just say, this is the vibe I got. Am I right? And he'll go, great. Here's your pay rise. Let's go.
There we go. And then I can get like 10%.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. And I guess to wrap things up, sometimes, or most of the times recently, actually, for the last 2 or 3 episodes, Oliver, I've been doing what I call a rapid fire round. So I have no idea what your responses are going to be. Genuinely, for the listeners, I have no idea what Oliver is going to say. But I ask questions around, informal questions, for example, pizza topping and whatnot. So you cool? Can I start that? Can I start the
rapid
fire?
Let's do it.
All right. Okay. Favorite pizza topping?
Some kind of cured meat. So prosciutto or salami or something along those lines.
Interesting. Well, mine's pineapple.
No, I was gonna say, surely it's not pineapple. You know what? I've been anti-pineapple for my entire life, and
Anti-pineapple? What
well, as on a
the
pizza, I love a pineapple in a fruit salad. And then 3 weeks ago, my brother-in-law was like, "Just try it," and I'll be honest, it was very good. So,
There you go,
yeah.
right? Because because usually pizzas, I'm so passionate, but with pizzas, they all taste more or less the same. Sure, like a cured meat, et cetera, olives, whatever. When you put the pineapple, it's this brand new perspective, innovation, as you guys call it, right?
Innovation, yeah, I love
One of
it.
our last guests said her favorite pizza topping was avocado. I looked at her, I was like,
No, I wouldn't publish that episode. That's no good.
I love it. Fun fact, she's the one from the UK, so
Oh, she's amazing then.
there we
She's
go. There we
right.
go. 180 degrees. Okay, if you could pick one superpower, what would it be?
Freeze or manipulate time. I'm between work and family and social life. We're also trying to renovate our house. I'm training for an ultra marathon. I don't have time to do any of this. So I would love just to be able to pause time each day and just spend like a few hours doing things I need to get done.
Oh, that's cool. Question. But would you want, so if you're freezing time, well, I think that's a pretty obvious one, but if you're manipulating time, would you want your own time to be manipulated or everyone else's around you as well?
I would want to be able to control everyone's time. And I
Oh,
wouldn't want to
damn.
age. I also thought about
Oh.
this because not that I wouldn't want to age at all, but the trouble with freezing time for everyone apart from yourself is you age still, right? So there's a world in which you would get older just a little bit each time, but eventually you would look, let's say, like you're 80 and everyone else you know would be 60. So there's a little caveat there.
Oh wow, you've really thought this through. That's insane. Mine's simple. It's just teleportation. I don't want
That's
to get
also
on.
much easier.
That's easy. Yeah, and also, well, you know what I would, if I had teleportation, I would open the next FedEx. I can get overnight, over a minute shipping, man. I can get whatever you want, wherever you want in seconds.
You'd be a
$1,000.
billionaire straight away.
Oh, literal overnight billionaire, exactly, if not a
And
trillionaire.
think of the corporate fund you could open up. Your value add would be insane. You'd be the only
Oh
person
my
that could do
God.
that.
Our value add is just shipping.
Yeah.
That's who we invest in. We have like some
Logistics fund.
proprietary technology to get your funds, to get your product to anywhere in the world in seconds.
Look at that. Amazing.
And then go to comfort food.
It's a food called tartiflette, which is I eat it very rarely because you can only get it in the Alps in France, but it's the ultimate comfort food. It's essentially potatoes, cheese, cream, onions, a little bit of bacon. It's like, honestly, it's absolute heaven. It's incredible, but
You know what,
you would
since
never eat it in the UK, so it's a very rare treat.
we're talking about rare treats, I'll tell you, when I was in Slovenia, I went up this hill. There's shepherds on this hill, a kilometer in the sky, and there's cows all over. Anyway, and then there was one restaurant, and they served beef stew all over. It was so good. Maybe it was from the beef there, the cows there, but it was so good. It was delicious, and I remember taking photos, videos, and my family was very confused why I'm embracing such a simple bowl of beef stew so much. But when you're 2 kilometers in the sky enjoying a warm bowl of beef stew surrounded by cows, it's different.
Maybe it's that, maybe it's because you had to work hard to get it. And maybe now you're saying it, that's why I like this dish, because you've got to either climb up or ski down a mountain to enjoy it. So maybe it's that. I never thought about
That is the common theme here, it seems. And then, if your life was a movie, what genre would it be?
Okay, so firstly, it would have to be a short movie, not because I want a short life, but my unpopular opinion is that pretty much every movie in the world is too long. I'm not a movie guy. But in terms of genre, it would have to be a mixture of adventure and family comedy, because everything at home is just nuts at the moment. I don't know. I can't think of an adventure family comedy crossover, but whatever that is, that would be the film.
Interesting. Actually, very interesting. Mine, I think I would be happy if my life was a bit of a mystery or like mind bending,
Oh,
but
nice.
maybe because those are the kinds of films I watch. So maybe I'm just looking at
You're biased.
the very biased. Who wants a mind bending life, Oliver? Yeah, that's definitely biased.
Mystery's good though. Mind bending, I don't
Last question. Favorite way to spend a lazy Sunday afternoon?
So I laughed at this question because lazy is no longer possible as I've got an 18-month-old toddler at home. But Today's
Monday.
You said
18 months. I thought you said 18 years. Sorry.
No, that would, I'm not that old. It's 18 months. So that would, but today's Monday. Yesterday was Sunday, and we had a really good day. So I did a nice long run because that's my sort of independent space where no one can distract me. Had a nice coffee afterwards, then went to the park with my son, which was lovely, burnt off some energy, and then just got home, got the candles on like you saw last time I chatted, got some music on, and just chilled out in the evening. It was wonderful.
That's nice. Sounds very pure. Mine,
very pure.
A bit more simpler. I just, you know, just watching Netflix, I guess, on my screen. I thought you don't like movies.
No, I'd love to. I like documentary. I was saying this yesterday. I was like, God, remember the time when we used to just spend Sundays just like in a duvet watching Netflix, watching documentaries? That time is gone, sadly, I think, for me.
I might be back. I hear that when kids hit 3 or 4 years, apparently things get
great,
nicer, so easier.
But 2.5 years more to go.
There we go. Well, I wish you the best of luck. But all of our jokes aside, super, super happy that we did this. I personally learned a lot. I love your perspective on not just on the platform function, but also just how your background ties into platform, ties into the fund itself. And it's, you know, it's very evident you guys are doing a great job, and I'd love to have you on again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Mash. Really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Take care.
Take care.
I was just listening to the episode in post-production, and I just realized every time we come back to the pizza topic discussion with any guest, I get so, so, so passionate. This time when Oliver confessed his love for pineapple towards the end, which he may or may not have done directly, I was very happy because, hey, once again, I got my point across that pineapple isn't that bad of a pizza topping. But jokes aside, what I realized interviewing Oliver is that platform is a holistic function for your VC fund. It's not just about you sitting down with founder number 5 behind door number 3 and hoping things work out. But as you're working with your founders, you need to be considering how your actions and the results that come from it align with your fund's overall brand and mission over the next decade. I do think it's a little bit different for Oliver, given that they're a CVC fund and they technically only have one LP, so their accountabilities and priorities may be vastly different compared to the average VC fund. But that being said, I do sincerely believe there were lots of lessons to draw from, and I really hope you had a great time. I guess that's what happens when the guest answers your questions with full honesty and shows you both the good and the bad sides to everything. I highly recommend you reach out to Oliver on LinkedIn. As always, I'll put his profile link below in the show notes, and I'll see you next time on the Value Add Pod. I personally find video podcasts are a lot more fun to watch. So if you want to watch the video version of this pod, head on over to YouTube and type in Hire CMO Pod. That's HIRECMO space POD, like podcast, and we should come up. Enjoy and have a fantastic evening or night.